Oh, thank you, John, for the introduction. I want to thank all of you for coming out. Somebody told me that it's 13 degrees outside, so you are the few and the mighty. Or you could even be called the chosen ones. Hopefully you'll be something worth choosing for. I wanted to talk about a few things this evening. The title is The Present Need. Actually, I talked about this subject in India when we had our international convention back in December. And, you know, thinking about it, to talk about it tonight, I talk about it in a completely different way. Probably when we get right down to it, as we go along, we'll see that when I talk about the present need, that pretty much there's one need that I'm referring to, and we'll get to that. But just to paint the scene, obviously from my point of view, one of the things that is important is trying to address something about this kind of disconnect that we see in the world between the material world, which is largely described as the real world, and the inner world, or the world that's of consciousness, or the world of spirit, which, you know, some would say is an unreal world. Others would say that that, in fact, is the world that precipitates this other one that we deem to be so very, very real. So there's something of a disconnect, and it has created some issues, some very pronounced issues in the way we approach living in the world today. And so we have to kind of find a way to create some sort of balance in the way that we view it. And because we're so overbalanced in one direction, which is to say the direction of clinging to what we might describe as a material reality, maybe we'll spend some time this evening addressing our attention toward the other side of the balance. Not neglecting the fact that we do live in bodies and in a world that we are affecting. So anyway, from the theosophical point of view, Theosophical Society came into being, probably many of you know, back in 1875. And at that time, it was kind of a radical and revolutionary idea. This whole thing about the one life and the unity of all life, universal brotherhood, that sort of thing was a very different concept. Now, it's quite accepted. But at that time, one of the things that came forward was, in fact, this body of knowledge spoken of as the ageless wisdom, something that has existed throughout all time and finds itself expressed in every religion that has ever existed throughout humanity's time on Earth, this ageless wisdom. So at the very outset, it was said that there are certain very fundamental things that we have to grasp before we can really grasp more deeply the basis for this whole deeper wisdom. Actually, from the point of view of Helena Blavatsky, the one who was one of the founders, she spoke about three fundamental propositions that we have to wrap our heads around before we can really understand, because it's the basis for everything that flows from that. It's the basis for whatever thinking we develop about reincarnation, karma, past lives, future lives. It's all rooted in certain fundamental propositions. And the fact of the matter is, it's unlikely that we will fully grasp and fully understand those. But until we give some attention to them, we're just sort of picking an idea here, picking an idea there, without the necessary background. So these fundamental propositions, I'll give you all three, but in an abbreviated form, because H.P. Blavatsky was rather long-winded in her expression. Those of you who have read her might know. But really want to focus more so on one of those. But the three were that it begins with the idea that there is an absolute, omnipresent, unchanging first principle out of which everything emanates. So this is sort of the background of everything we call reality. It lies beneath it, permeates it, but it's not something we can describe. It's not something that we can paint or explain. The way that Lao Tzu expressed it, talking about the Tao, you know, the great, the Tao, the Tao that can be named is not the true Tao. So there's no possible way of describing, but still, we need to at least make the mental attempt to establish that there is something that undergirds this entire reality. And so that's number one. The second fundamental proposition that she spoke about was that there are patterns that we become quite aware of, and that they are so universal that it's really one of the most fundamental things we can talk about in the universe, which is that there are cycles that are constantly occurring at every single level. At the most basic level, we see every day, day and night, occurring. There's the cycle of the Earth's revolution around the sun. That's a year. The same way that the Earth is revolving around the sun, this entire solar system is revolving around the center of a galaxy that is comprised of billions of such solar systems. So this pattern applies from the very, very micro, from the smallest, all the way to the top. These cyclic alternations. And we're supposed to kind of think about this and try and identify, to the extent that we can, these cycles. And you know, as you start to think about it, you start to become aware of deeper aspects of these same cycles. Such things as reincarnation. You know, the fact that there is birth, we go through a life, the body dies, and then there's this process that repeats. Various sorts of degrees of this cycle. It's even said to be the same thing that takes place with universes. That in essence, universes are breathed out and come into existence, have their time, and even though that time is immense in terms of the numbers that we're capable of considering, that ultimately then they're again breathed back in, and the process continues. So there is this absolute, and then there are these cycles. And we begin to understand that and turn our attention toward it. The third fundamental proposition, and the one that I think I'll spend the most time tonight talking about, is this proposition that all souls, you know, now we get to the level of human beings, that every soul, which is to say the spiritual spark that incarnates within a body, every soul, there is an identity of all souls with an oversoul, as it said. So there's this sort of emanation. You could see it a lot like the sun. Countless rays that radiate out from the sun. But ultimately, if you track it all back, it all comes from this one source. And the same is said to be the case for the soul of every human being. But as part of that, this soul is engaged again in one of these cycles. And that the cycle is what's described as an obligatory pilgrimage. That this spark that emanates from the divine, this soul, on being emanated, becomes involved in this obligatory pilgrimage. It must pass through a certain sort of cycle. And that cycle involves a couple of things. And this is where we'll probably spend our time this evening. That the main aspect is that before that soul can really gain its own individuality, before it can be something capable of expressing from its own self-aware consciousness, it has to go through a process that involves first development and unfoldment through what's described as natural impulse. Natural impulse, and that's really where I think I want to lay for a moment. It's natural impulse, and then self-induced and self-devised efforts come next. So the idea for us is that in this pilgrimage, you know, where we find ourselves being born and where we find ourselves ultimately awakening and trying to develop, unfold our consciousness, that this process begins through natural impulse. So what does that mean? Basically, what we're talking about there is that the way we develop in our early stages is by being impelled, by being driven by nature. Which is to say, you know, like the wind blows leaves, that's sort of the way in our early development we're more reactive than we are responsive. So, you know, natural things arise, you know, it's cold outside, we develop ways to keep ourselves warm. You know, we find ourselves in conflict with other animals or conditions in nature, we create ways to deal with that, but it's all being driven by the external forces around us. And that's the way we begin. Now, this is a stage prior to where our efforts are self-generated, self-induced, self-devised. So anyway, when we start to think about natural, what is nature? An idea I think has developed among us as people. In fact, if you were to look into the dictionary, you'd see it pretty well laid out. An expression of one of the ways we've gone wrong. Or, you know, rather than call it one of the ways we've gone wrong, just one of the ways that we have come to perceive the world. Nature, from a dictionary definition, would be the physical phenomena, all physical phenomena collectively, which includes the plant world, the animal world, the landscape, and the various products of the earth, except for human beings and human creations. So nature's everything but us, is basically the way it boils down. And that's the way we tend to regard nature. I never see anyone go to New York City and come back and describe the beautiful nature. They may talk about the wildlife on the subways, but they're not talking about nature in the normal sense. So we have this idea that in some way there is nature and there is us. And we stand apart from it. And then we take on this sort of biblical idea that we are the stewards of nature. Our role is to control and to direct nature and its processes. And that's a dangerous idea. It's dangerous particularly because we can really see some of the results of that way of interacting with the greater environment. The fact of the matter is that nature, in any way we describe it, is very susceptible to human impact. Perhaps in olden times, it was much less so. But in the last 200, 300 years, the human imprint on the planet and on the natural processes and on the climate has been enormous. To the extent that the influence of human beings is one of the main features now of the cycles of nature and the processes of nature. And it's something that now we are finding that the impulse that is put upon us by nature is really almost a reflection of our own state of consciousness. So, you know, how do we react with nature? You know, what is the impress of humanity on the natural world? And when you look at it, it takes place at many, many different levels. I mean, one of the basic ideas of this whole view of spirituality or ageless wisdom sorts of teachings is that a basic fact is that we live in a multi-dimensional universe. And we, of course, are multi-dimensional as well. So, you know, this whole idea that has been gained such credence in the world today, that in some way the universe and its processes can be somehow reduced to only what happens within the physical world, is something that's clearly mistaken. The whole idea of contemporary science today, it's also described as reductionism or reductionistic materialism, that the universe is only this narrow slice that can be measured, can be observed, can be known through the senses or the instruments that enhance the senses. That's sort of the view of what the real world is from a scientific point of view. And it's clearly one that doesn't work. And it doesn't work for very obvious reasons. One is that it doesn't account in any way for the process that's going on with each and every one of us in this room right now, which is to say that each and every one of us is conscious. Each and every one of us is experiencing the processes of consciousness at multiple levels, which cannot be measured and cannot be defined by any sort of material method. So it's a narrow band. In fact, we're in a very unusual period in the sense that there never has been a period in time in known human history where the people that were alive viewed themselves as living in a cosmos that was not sacred. We find ourselves in that situation, where the prevailing view of the universe, the cosmos we inhabit, is that it is a large machine. That idea is starting to crack, obviously. But it's something that is a very new phenomenon in the development of human beings and human consciousness. So we impact this natural world, and we do it in a number of ways. There is this idea that has been advanced. The contemporary version of the idea is what's talked about as the Gaia hypothesis, or the Gaia idea, you know, that the Earth is described as Gaia. And it is described as an organism. You know, it is a single conscious being and a self-regulating being in much the same way that we are. You know, we don't have any problem thinking of ourselves as a thing, a being. Even though, you know, at the sixth grade science level, we know that we're composed of several trillion independent life forms, the independent cells in our bodies, that have no care, no worry, no thought about this great being, me. But we have no problem thinking of ourselves as a being of that sort. But this next step up is this idea that, in fact, the planet is like that, which is something that's in keeping with ageless wisdom tradition. So there is this vast consciousness in which we all participate. Human beings have their role, as do all of the other kingdoms of nature. The human role tends to be rather specific, in the sense that it seems as if particularly contemporary humanity, one of the things that we have been very good at has been, you could describe it as intensification or concentration. So wherever we find ourselves, wherever we find ourselves interacting with various processes in nature, there's an intensification that takes place. And so if it's on the physical realm, things are intensified. And particularly in our time, it's having effects. Because here's one way. Again, a lot of what brings us to this particular moment in time is a couple of threads of thought that have become predominant over the last short while. So short while meaning 400 or 500 years. But one of the outcomes of this, this huge spread that has taken place, an industrial revolution that took place, and that has now spread to the entire planet, that was remarkable in terms of the creation, the creative processes that went on within human society. All sorts of things came out of that. But one of the byproducts that we're living with now is that part of this intensification, there was an examination of nature, and a ability was developed to split aspects of it so that you could extract needed compounds, so chemicals that were used in the industrial process. It was discovered how to extract these and how to utilize them, and for great, great purposes. I mean, the sort of agricultural revolution that took place that allowed small fields to generate huge crops as a result of the input of strong chemicals was seen as a miracle that was going to really turn the world around. You know, nothing wrong with growing more food until you get about 20, 30 years down the line. And you find that the chemicals that were used have other effects. And they found their way into the earth. They found their way into the air. They found their way into the waters. And so this intensification of this one aspect of the natural world creates imbalances. And it takes place on less gross levels as well. I mean, I don't know if you think about this, but you know, it's a normal, for as long as there has been an earth, there has been an electromagnetic spectrum. You know, there's always been light and radio waves and gamma rays and microwaves. That whole spectrum has always been around and has always sort of played in the background on the plant life and the human life that has been available at any given time in history. In this particular time, again, with this intensification, certain aspects of this electromagnetic spectrum have been hugely intensified. I mean, you sit in this room now, and if John hadn't told you to turn off your phone, you wouldn't hear me talking, because it would be ringing for about 4 or 5 of you, as popular as you all look. It would have happened. You know, and that's something that is playing upon us at all times. Radio waves from radio shows, from TV, just the constant background from the upsurge in the use of electricity by itself. It's a constant background anywhere you are on the planet now. And, you know, what the effects are, you know, who's to say? It may be none, but certainly it's something. When I was in Adyar, that's to say in India, a couple of months back, there's a young fellow who was there, and he's, I don't know how he manages this, but he's deeply involved in communication technology and electrical engineering. But one of the things we had done there at the living quarters area, you know, this was like revolutionary at the Theosophical Society in India. We put in Wi-Fi internet connections. Welcome to the revolution. So, Wi-Fi internet. And we had to plug in some extenders, you know, so we could reach farther than where the original signal came. Great. Everybody loved it. But this one particular fellow has a sensitivity to those sorts of radio waves. So for him, it was something that caused headaches and affected his sleep. And he has that wherever he goes. He's an electrical engineer. He's developed ways of masking it. But here's a person whose sensitivity is such that the things that we may not be aware of consciously, he's very much aware of and very much affected by. And so, you know, who's to say what these electro-intensification of these certain bands of the electromagnetic spectrum, what's going to be the outcome of that? We do know one of the effects of, again, our mastery to the degree that we have of chemistry is that we have, you know, we're depleting the ozone layer. You know, the fluorocarbons go up and they break down the ozone. You know, you would think, what's the big deal? You know, it's miles up in the sky. But then they find that, of course, with the ozone layer breaking down, that damaging ultraviolet rays are getting through, and all of a sudden, everybody who used to lay at the beach with copper tone tanning lotion on when I was a kid is now afraid of the sun because skin cancer, because human interaction with the natural world. So these are some of the effects. And then, you know, probably the area that has the greatest effect is the one that's the least seen. And we talk about the electromagnetic spectrum and chemical reactions. That's one thing. You can test all of those sorts of things. But then you have something that you could describe as subtle energies that are constantly at play and are probably the bulk of everything that we respond to. But these are things that are not physically measurable, but things that are actually known from their effects. And you take an example. Just in the Theosophical Society, there was a woman who probably many of you knew, Dora Kuntz. She was a past president, quite well known for her work with the medical community because she had one of these highly developed sort of clairvoyant abilities. So she interacted with a lot of that. But one of the things she also did, she was fascinated with the phenomenon of healing. You know, healing that does not involve touch. You know, what do they call it? Sometimes it was called laying on of hands or energy healing. But she was fascinated with that. So she started to actually observe some of these healers and work with them. And whenever she would talk to the healers, and she'd say, what is it that you're doing? They'd say, most of them would say, it's something that's just given to me from God. I can't explain it. It can't be taught. But then when she watched, because she was looking at what was happening, she became aware that these subtle energies are in fact things that could be, we could cultivate the means for anybody to do that to some degree. You may not be as great as these great healers, but anybody can project these energies, these healing energies, if you understand a little bit and engage in a process. And so she worked with a woman who was then with the New York University School of Nursing, Dolores Krieger. What Dolores did was this. She brought the scientific element to it. She knew she couldn't test any sort of wavelength coming from the hands of the healers. So what she did instead was test the patient. And she found that in every case, you could witness something occurring after the person did the healing. And one of the things that occurred was there was this obvious, what's called relaxation response. So the body responds in this way where it relaxes. That's one thing. But there were other things, but most notable was that she noticed that the hemoglobin, the red cells in the blood, that their uptake of oxygen increased dramatically. And this was something that was demonstrable time after time after time. You couldn't demonstrate anything about the energy itself. But by its effects and the effects on the patients, it was known. And that's just one example. I mean, all of us are impacted by emotions, by thoughts, by environments that are filled with these emotions and thoughts. We all have that. Anybody who's ever sat down, with someone who is depressed and spent any time around them, you know, one-on-one time, what's the effect? I mean, you leave and you're depleted. And, you know, what happened? There was no chemical in the air. You know, there was no electromagnetic light radiating. It's these subtle energies that are beyond the spectrum of what is as yet measurable that are constantly playing upon us. I'll give you an example. One of the past presidents of the Theosophical Society years ago, Annie Besant, she was quite sensitive, and she had her clairvoyant abilities as well. But she described one time when she was coming to Chicago. She was on a train, and this would have been 1920s, maybe. And she was sitting in the train, and she was sort of half asleep, just relaxing. And she said, all of a sudden, this completely unfamiliar feeling of just dread and fear and depression just came over her, to the point that she just kind of woke up and wondered, what's going on here? And it was only then that she realized, at that time, Chicago was known as the slaughterhouse for the world. You know, it was the slaughterhouse district over there in near 47th Street and Halsted. And millions of animals were being dispatched. And what she became very clearly aware of was the perception of this atmosphere that spread out from the center of the city. She was on the outskirts of the city. She wasn't even there yet. And she became aware of it. And, you know, just in terms of that particular time, one of the things that went on was there were sociologists. Because the stockyard neighborhood, which they called the area around the slaughterhouses, was known for high levels of crime. And so there was criminal activity, and most of it was violent criminal activity as well. And so the idea is this, that where you find yourself in an atmosphere that is pervaded by fear, that is pervaded by these subtle energies of violence, those sorts of emotions, those things react upon one. That's the premise behind this whole idea of subtle energies. We are most familiar with these energies in the form of emotional and mental sorts of things, but there are higher states as well. And that's something that, before the night's over, we'll get there. But in the meantime, these are the ways that we are impacting the natural world. Additionally, we have beyond just intensifying things, we also have the capacity for creativity. I mean, in fact, even in this process of interacting with chemicals, things have come into the world that didn't even exist here before. You know, plastics, however you may think they're good or bad, it's not something that even existed in nature. It was a human creation. There are sounds that we hear now every day that have never existed in nature, that have been generated through electrical means, through music synthesizers. So our children are growing up with a whole spectrum of materials, a whole spectrum of sound, that they're being called upon to hear and to feel and to perceive in ways that weren't even possible for us. So there's a creative aspect to it as well. But where we end up is this. There's an impact on the world now that we have had, to the extent that what we describe as nature is making certain demands at the moment. As a result of the way in which the forms our interactions with nature have taken, nature is making some very clear demands that are appearing to us as crises. There was a statement made by a gentleman. I like the way he put it. He was talking about the traditional methods that the ancient spiritual masters taught their wisdom. I think one of the things that holds us back sometimes in terms of our grasp of these deeper things is that we think that they can be taught in the ways that we're accustomed to. And we want them to be taught to us in those ways. So, teacher can stand up, can tell you what it is, you can go to the book, go home and do your homework, and your consciousness unfolds. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way, not with this particular teaching. And I say unfortunately, but it's very fortunate that it does not work that way, that it's not something that can be just purchased in the local bookstore and then played with. But the way that he described this teaching method was that he said that every fresh idea was impressed upon the mind. This is the part that I like. Impressed upon the mind by provoking the perplexity that it at last relieved. You like that? And do you get it? Basically, it provoked some sort of crisis, this teaching that was to be grasped, this next unfoldment in the awareness and the consciousness was attained by provoking a crisis that the realization of that teaching relieved the crisis. And that's the traditional teaching method. And it's not one that we generally want to sign up for. Because, you know, crises, we got enough of them without provoking some more perplexities. And yet, for whatever reason, we find ourselves at a time now where what we're facing is perplexities of a global nature. I mean, there's a whole list of them, and you could add to them more than I can. Deserts are growing everywhere around the world. The earth, the air, the water, soiled. Even outer space now. You know they've got garbage falling back to earth from outer space? Old used satellites and stuff are just kind of dropping out of the sky now and then. All of that's going on. You've got seas that have been fished dry almost. They can't reproduce fast enough to keep up with the fish that are being dragged out of the sea. A lot of them are being dragged out largely to be used as fertilizer for crops. You've got wars, 64 of them going on at last count. 64 wars, and I don't get this part, 64 wars and supposedly 600 different groups involved in fighting those wars. So it's 10 per war. So you don't even know who you're shooting at anymore. Wars are abounding. You know, you take your pick of what the particular crises are, but they're here, and they're real. And they're, in many respects, imminent. And so we find ourselves asking, you know, what is the right response? How do we respond to this? And you know, there's a real problem. We know a lot of things. You know, human being, we have great knowledge in many, many areas. And the fact of the matter is that you could pick any one of these problems and you wouldn't need a new invention. You don't need a new invention to apply a cure. Everything necessary to address each and every one of these problems is present now. We have that knowledge. But it's not happening. At least for me, it causes me to ask a question. The question would be then, why? And perhaps, you know, the missing element? Knowledge in and of itself isn't enough. It's not going to do it. I find myself coming back to this quote from Albert Einstein, and I find myself more and more saying it. He made the observation, others have made a similar one, that no problem can be solved on the level of consciousness that created it. There is no problem that can be solved at the same level of consciousness that created that problem. Because what you do is, you know, the knowledge that brought it into being is the knowledge you try to apply to solve it. And so you have examples all around us. You know, you can take a very familiar one of an approach that we've engaged in for too long. You know, you have wars. I talked about 64 of them. So, where there's a war, what is the approach to addressing that? I think you know. If there's an uprise in violence, well, the only way we can really deal with it, we know this, is to apply superior violence. You know, if your violence is greater, then that violence will become diminished. And so peace then reigns. Right. You know, it works on a number of levels. Obviously, we know that does not work. Nobody whose parents, whose children have been murdered in war find themselves feeling particularly peaceful in that process. Rarely do they find themselves feeling forgiving. Additionally, just from the sort of basic metaphysical point of view, you kill a body. The consciousness does not suddenly just go away. Body dies, consciousness free of the body, a consciousness that is now pervaded with hatred, fear, a sense of violence. That becomes a part of the greater atmosphere. You know, I told you about Annie Besant's experience coming into Chicago. That becomes a part of the shared atmosphere, just like the chemicals coming up at the factory in Chicago are part of the atmosphere in New England and in China. I mean, just look a little deeper. So that doesn't work. So obviously what is required is something that exceeds the limitations of the knowledge that we have embraced right now. And that's why we find ourselves sort of hovering on this precipice that there must be something more. And so people find themselves in masses around the world asking these deeper questions and looking for the answer to what more is there. The beauty of it is that it's a question that we ask already knowing the answer. That's the part that is hopeful. Because there is no one who has some slight level of development who is not aware that there is, in fact, something more profound that is living through this body in some way, whatever you call it, soul, spirit, whatever you call it. And so how is it then that we connect with that? You know, and really the question is, this brings us to the whole sort of topic of what is the present need? What is it that we need right now that exceeds the knowledge of the day, that relates to some sort of genuine connection and experience with that more profound unfoldment of consciousness that we know is there and is awaiting. Yet somehow or another, we can't quite get there. So, really, there's one need. There's only one thing that is needed. But in order for that one thing, there's a second. Let's talk about the one. What really is required of us now is a reacquaintance with what we could call our capacity for intuition. Not intuition in a sense of psychic premonition, no. Intuition in the sense of how it's described, say, in biblical terms, of the still small voice that is continually speaking within us, that profound voice that orients us rightly. In Sanskrit, it's spoken of as buddhi. You hear the Dalai Lama speaking a great deal these days about compassion. The sense, the capacity to sense the unity of life, the connectedness of life, the inseparability of all beings, is a sort of awareness that is game-changing. It alters everything. It makes such things as petty wars an impossibility. Native Americans emphasize this idea that anything you do, you need to think of its effects seven generations ahead. How is this act I'm doing today going to affect the seventh generation? How is this tree that I'm cutting down or this tree that I'm planting? What's its effect on the seventh generation? We look to this sense of connectedness with a much greater whole that exceeds time, that exceeds space. When we're able to kind of grasp that, we behave very, very differently, necessarily. It's one of these big ideas that seems too big to be practical. But when you try it, and the way we try it really is through, the whole thing takes place through a perception and a connection with others. To the extent we're capable of connecting with others, thinking about others, and broadening that sphere, this whole capacity becomes stronger. That's the real need. And that's something that can be cultivated. The problem we face is the reason why I say there's a second need that might even be more important than the first, because unless we do something about this one, you'll never get there. There was a great Buddhist sage by the name of Nagarjuna, and he was responsible for some very profound thinking in Buddhist realms. But one of the things he said that without the discipline of guarding the mind, what use are all other disciplines? Without the discipline of protecting the mind and the mind stream, what use is anything else that you do? Another way you could put it is, of all the things we will lose, our mind is the thing that we'll miss the most. You put it that way. Maybe Nagarjuna didn't say that, but hey. Protecting the mind. Everybody is aware. There's nobody who is not aware today that, you know, if you stand in a toxic environment, it can have effects on you. You know, children who are born and raised next to factories that emit all sorts of emissions, get asthma, they have lung conditions. People who smoke, secondhand smoke, people are affected by that. We all know that. And so, you know, just in our attention to the body, we're wise enough to take precautions. So if the water's not clean, we filter it. You know, if we're going to be around toxic things, we put on gloves. We put on masks. But every one of us will walk out the door in the morning. Many people will go to a work environment where the person sitting next to them and the person next to them is angry about something, unhappy about many things, depressed, irritable, anxious, you know, the whole nine yards. And we'll swim in that sea all day and come home, feel a little bit depleted. And what do? Well, let me sit up and relax. Let me watch some TV. Turn on the TV, see a show with an angry, unhappy, anxious person being violent about something or other. And that's relaxation. We treat our bodies better than we treat our minds, let's face it. And it's not because we don't want to do something. I think largely it's just because we just don't know. Or because it's invisible, we don't think it has value. So, you know, basic program of protecting your mind allows for these other developments that are much more profound. And so what do you do to protect your mind? A lot of people, you go out, and when you come back home, there's a simple thing that a lot of people may not value, but it's real. A shower. Water. Part of what we pick up is a certain sort of magnetism during the course of a day that we can slough off. You know, you come home and you rinse off. And a lot of that stuff will wash away from you. I mean, that's a basic thing. You create an environment where, you know, you can feel at ease. You regulate the fragrances that uplift, the sounds that soothe. These are all things that affect the mind. And then there are other ways that people who involve in a meditation practice. And probably the most overlooked and one of the most powerful things that you can do that almost nobody does is two names it's called by. In the West, it tends to be spoken of as prayer. In the East, it tends to be spoken of as mantra. The recitation of phrases that have the capacity to shape and alter the mind stream is exceedingly powerful. And you know, a lot of people think they have to have 20 minutes to sit down in the morning to do that. How many times are you standing in line during the course of a day? How many times are you walking from place to place during the course of a day? Every one of those are moments when the mind is generally unprotected. So, just a few ideas. Without a doubt, there's a need. Without a doubt, there's a capacity that we have to respond to this need. There's an expression that no snowflake in an avalanche ever feels responsible. All the bad guys have caused everything that's going on around us, not this snowflake. But we're all wrapped up in it. It's inseparable. And so the beauty of it is that just a little touch, just the slightest acquaintance with this deeper dimension, this intuitive, this still small voice within us, one person who is in touch in that way, among 1,000 who are confused, that one person is a majority. And this is the sort of quality that is there for the asking. But we have to take care of this sort of preventive mode, this protection mode. Has any of this made sense? All right. Let me wrap it up there. I thank you for your attention. And at the minimum, you've had a chance to be in a very warm place. Well, look, I think the custom is to have questions, so if you want to do that.
Why do you think that it seems as though, even though everything that you just discussed is pervasive and grows bigger, that what doesn't grow bigger is the leadership and the enlightenment that would, just as you did, that reminds us all of these basically, you know, simple issues and tasks, and why doesn't it seem like with everything that we have accessible to us that we find less and less of that proportionately with compared to all the noise that is happening?
Yeah. One of the things in certain sorts of cosmologies, there's this idea of golden ages and dark ages. And this is said to be a dark age. You know, Kali Yuga is what it's spoken of. And they say one of the features, one of the ways you can know that it's a dark age is when everything is important except that which is important. And so you look around, and we may have some of those characteristics at the moment. But I think the good part is that probably there is no place, whether government, business, there is no place where this consciousness isn't arising. It's not one of those things that we tend to witness if we're looking for it in media reports, because generally it doesn't bleed, so it doesn't make it to the front page. But it's certainly there. And it's one of those things that at this point I find myself doing a fairly significant amount of travel, which puts me in touch with, you know, a variety of different people. And it's not just a U.S. process. It's not just a European process. This is something that is actually, it's there. It's becoming quite firmly rooted in the world. And, you know, its moment is arising. It's on its way. What's necessary, of course, is our contribution.
You're saying consciousness is arising, a pervasively better consciousness. Did you ever hear of a condor and eagle, sort of an Indian projection of the time where the condor is a positive influence coming together with the eagle, which is materialism?
I hadn't heard that particular legend, but...
Okay, so that's kind of what you're talking about, though, this kind of coming together and using materialism and spiritualism together? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I did come here tonight because I saw your talk was more about environmental mm-hmm. issues. And I became aware of it through native plants. I belong to a group called the Wild Ones, and we plant natives in our yards because we want to preserve biodiversity, and in that way, in that small way, preserve the planet. Mm-hmm. So I guess I see what you're saying is that in each mind there's a small way of coming together, in a sense, like biodiversity, preserving the native seed. So that's kind of how I'm seeing what you're saying. And so from my own background, too, I had gone to Starved Rock because they have sand mines there for the fracking, and the sand mines will be all around that whole park. So, yeah, I'm working towards, you know, making people aware, especially at the legislative level, of the, you know, the negative downside of this. And I do, little by little. You know, I see a change. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would like to know, you know, what do you think about that kind of activism in the world and the usefulness of it, you know, that kind of direct... Mm-hmm.
It Yeah, there are models for it that have been very successful. You look at Mahatma Gandhi, for instance, activism of that sort. You know, really what's required now is everything. You know, the question was asked of some great spiritual master, what can I do to help mankind? And the answer, what can you do? Because whatever it is, anything you do done with a full heart will benefit humanity. And particularly because it becomes attractive as well. You draw others to that sort of activity. And even if you don't, there's this expression about prayer that people say prayers and that they really need to, they have no idea. The prayer they say here affects someone on the other side of the world who they will never know. And it's the same thing with any sort of good act, any sort of positive thought, any sort of upliftment spreads through the whole, just like any sort of pollutant spreads through the whole. And we're very conscious of that now.
Tim, I was wondering, you mentioned about the positive and the negative and the one person being more powerful than a thousand. Now, exactly why is that? Like, is an example like the positive energy, is that like you're connected with the divine mind and you're going with the flow of the river and all the negativity has no energy, so that's going against the flow? Why is a positive person, why is positive energy stronger than negative energy?
Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful book. I've forgotten the fellow's full name. His name is Dr. Hawkins, and it's a book called Power versus Force. Is anybody aware of that book, Power versus Force? He talks about the difference between force as, you know, something that's manipulative and power. And so you take a person, this fellow Krishnamurti, very expanded, very illumined consciousness. Whatever you may think of him, he made the statement at one point that if there were 10 people with the particular sort of consciousness that he had in the world, that the world would change. Whether you believe that's true about him or not, the idea is that an atom bomb is a very small thing, but its power far exceeds, you know, you could stack up 1,000 boxes of dynamite and it wouldn't be the equal of that. And it's the same sort of thing. The closer we get to a source of power, the more radiant it is, the more effect it has.
There is a question from someone online. How can the individual make the machine more sacred?
Well, I think probably the first way would be to stop looking at it as a machine. That's sort of the idea that we have adopted, which gives it the idea that somehow or another this is an inanimate, non-living sort of creation that we function within. But I think if we can go beyond that idea, then we start to become aware that it is a participatory organism, and that the main feature, the most organic feature about it is, in fact, consciousness. So that's something that is can be affected by consciousness. Linked with consciousness is like water with water. You know, it all is part of one thing. So we're not separated in that sense.
Okay. There is one more question from someone online. Could you perhaps speak on the purpose of Maya or the forgetting of the unity?
Well, it's probably beyond my pay grade to speak in terms of the purpose of Maya. I mean, I could speculate just like the next guy, but I could talk something about the process of interacting with that. I mean, obviously we all find ourselves from that perspective, we sort of are trapped in this view of seeing things in the wrong way. So basically we're in this world and we see it, you know, as a machine, or we see it as a bunch of isolated entities outside. and we act accordingly. You know, because you're different from me, I am in competition with you. So that's the Maya of it. That's the illusion of it. For those who have had some sort of experience of another way of seeing, that's something that quickly fades away. Because really what becomes most prominent, even in our most basic moments where we can say, I have really felt like I'm very happy and at peace. You know, standing at home in your backyard, whatever it is. In that particular moment, if you were to really go back and check and see what the experience was, the experience was that some degree of this Maya slipped away. And the degree that slipped was this complete and constant fascination and involvement with me. That when we're happy, we're not really focused on ourselves in those moments. And so we feel expansive, we feel connected. And so just that talks about one way that we can approach this whole experience of dealing with this world in which we feel trapped in illusion. Where you see openings that allow for another way of seeing it, pursue those. Cultivate those. You know, Joseph Campbell made that statement, follow your bliss. A whole lot of people have been unemployed trying to follow that advice. But maybe that's not what he was talking about, you know? That, you know, from moment to moment, there are experiences that arise that if you follow them, they have this capacity of bliss, of moving beyond an isolated sense of self to something more real. And that's this gradual conquest of illusion. And it's gradual, because these experiences are momentary. But once you've had it, you can't unremember. And it becomes a touchstone.
So we're talking about individuals preserving their peace and their mind so that they can contribute to the environmental mind. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of corporate consciousness. And I guess I see us as having, as a people, you know, we're leaving a kind of this mechanistic age. We have to leave that behind, but you're talking about the machine idea, the kind of the fossil fuel driven in. Like you said, there are answers to grasp and to build a new world. So how does each mind, you know, besides preserving themselves, kind of, how do we all come together? You know, mm-hmm. to benefit ourself as a sort of a being.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a huge question.
Well, I mean, you take, for example, the 30, 40 people in the room now. And how did we get here? What brought us here? And so for different ones, different things. But for whatever reason, we find ourselves in each other's presence for these moments that we're here, and we share something. And then we go our way. And then we do it again in a different format, in a different place. So we already know how to do it. I mean, we do it. The poet said, I learn by going where I have to go. We learn by following, you know, it may not be our bliss, but it may be what we think is our bliss. You follow that. And it invariably leads you to a place, and something happens. And if it's something that you find is uplifting, then at that moment you're changed. Something shifts within you, and you start to function at a different level. And the next place you go, it takes on a slightly different character, and on and on. If you're lucky, you can find a group of people that can really strengthen this. There's a principle in spiritual life. In the Western world is well known as the idea that where two or three gather in the name of, and you can fill in the blank what the name is. in the name of peace, in the name of ecology, in the name of spiritual unfoldment. Where two or three gather in that name, it magnifies your capacity far beyond any individual's. We have difficulty doing that. I mean, in part because I think very often when we come someplace, often what we bring, even more than our deep desire to connect, is our personal issues and our sense that we're going to remain within certain clear limitations that we've established for ourselves. And I'm uncomfortable going beyond that. And as soon as I get pushed, I'm going to retreat. And because it's the way the world's set up in the West, we have that option. Much to our, it doesn't do us much good.